Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As U.S. troops closed in on the very outskirts of Baghdad today, the vaunted Republican Guard perimeter barely slowed them down. Now comes the urban warfare challenge, vulnerable civilians, desperate Iraqi fighters, and U.S. troops that want neither a siege nor a bloody onslaught. Tonight on Point, strategy, high stakes, and the battle for urban Baghdad. We begin with a view from U.S. Central Command headquarters in Doha, Qatar. Jonathan Marcus is military correspondent for the BBC. I asked him for the latest developments in and around Baghdad.
Well, what we've seen over the past 24 hours or so is two broad, very significant thrusts towards the Iraqi capital, which have brought U.S. forces within sight of Baghdad. We believe now that there are battles going on for control of the main international airport to the southwest of the city. A very important movement also from the southeast, from the direction of Al-Qut. This really could open up the whole eastern side of the Iraqi capital, enabling U.S. forces to secure that side of the city. And of course, we've heard also the role of special forces in interdicting, as the military put it, being able to attack traffic on the road from Tikrit into the capital. That's the road from the north southwards into Baghdad. All of that suggesting that over the next few days, if the American operations are successful, they could pretty well isolate the Iraqi capital from the rest of the country.
Jonathan Marcus, we're reading that U.S. commanders themselves were stunned by the speed of this final advance. How's it being interpreted? Is this a deliberate retreat and giving way by Iraqi forces, or is this they're being pummeled to bits, or they're just not up to the fight?
Well, it could be all of those things. It's very difficult to say at this stage. And I think the only word of caution one has to stress is that even senior American figures like Don Rumsfeld and Dick Myers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, are urging caution themselves. They're still saying there could be serious fighting ahead. I think what you are seeing, though, is a combination of a whole range of factors. Firstly, the success of the air and artillery bombardments of key Republican Guard units. You're seeing some movement of units to reinforce damaged units. You're seeing some movement of units back into the city, the outskirts of Baghdad. You're seeing some people simply drifting away back to their homes. You're seeing others surrendering. Clearly others are dying on the battlefield. So it is a very complex and confusing picture. Whether the Iraqis really still have the command and control necessary to launch some sort of significant blocking move or counteroffensive, it's still very early to say. Whether they would choose an opportunity like this to use chemical weapons, which would be particularly worrying given the proximity of urban areas and populated areas, is a very disturbing element as well. Of course, it's interesting because in broad terms, this move all the way up the Euphrates Valley in a little under 2 weeks or so, it's interesting that British commanders here at the Central Command base in Qatar are actually speaking with some admiration of their American colleagues. There are suggestions that this is a maneuver which will be studied in the military staff colleges for many years to come.
That maneuver being bypassing city centers in as far as possible and going straight for Baghdad, is that what you're referring to?
I think it's the speed of the advance, the way in which, as you say, key population centers were bypassed. It's the logistics, it's the fuel, the petrol, the munitions, the water, importantly in this case, that have kept this whole advance rolling and rolling at some considerable speed. And I think that is a remarkable operation in terms of the organization and the deployment of literally thousands of vehicles and thousands of tons of supplies and materiel.
We read that U.S. intelligence managed to intercept Iraqi orders that were trying to pull Republican Guard back toward the city for a final urban defense and brought in airstrikes that cut them off from doing that in great degree.
Well, I think that was one of the elements. How far they succeeded, we just don't know. The American intelligence is clearly vastly superior to that of the Iraqis. The Americans have control of the skies, which is obviously a central factor. How far they have actually been able to prevent units moving back into the outskirts of the city, we just don't know. Now, when you speak of a kind of urban, grand, Stalingrad-like defense, which is what a lot of the pundits have talked about, and the Iraqis, in a way, talk about this themselves, I fear they're likely to be disappointed. I mean, all the indications are that the Americans are not going to opt for that particular strategy. I think we're going to see some sort of halt around Baghdad once the city is enveloped and the last pockets of external resistance are destroyed. Now, then I think it's going to be very interesting whether that is going to lead to a very long stalemate, whether there are going to be other cards that the Americans will play. Remember, we're fixated on these advances from the south. There are many, many other elements of this war plan that have been far less visible, not least the special forces operations, and we don't know quite what the Americans may have in mind. Of course, a lot then depends on the dynamics of what goes on inside the Iraqi regime. Remember, Republican Guard units, by and large in the past, have been kept out of the Iraqi capital. They're not seen necessarily as being totally loyal to Saddam Hussein. In the past, there have been coup attempts from within the ranks of the officer corps of the Republican Guard. It's been the Special Republican Guard that has been responsible for security of the regime inside Baghdad. So there is a rich mix, if you like, of different factions, different groups in there. We don't know what the dynamics are inside the Iraqi leadership. We don't know if some of the Iraqi leaders may be dead, may not be dead. There's information, there's disinformation. It's a very confusing picture. But clearly, those dynamics will be critical as much as the purely military factors. And I suppose the Americans will be hoping for a situation where the whole edifice begins to crumble from within.
We saw Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld calling again today for Iraqi officers to come over to the U.S.-UK side. Do those officers hear those messages when Donald Rumsfeld delivers them from a podium in Washington?
Well, whether they hear them from there or whether they hear them because of calls on their mobile phones, which is one of the stories that we've heard, or whether there are clearly other contacts going on in the field, we just don't know. And it's certainly clear that some military officers have surrendered to the Americans. There doesn't seem to have been a phenomenon that's taken place in vast numbers. Many more units simply seem to have melted away, at least of the ordinary Iraqi regular army, as it were. We just don't know. I mean, the line from the Americans and indeed from the British as well is that there are many officers who would like to come over but are prevented from doing that by Ba'ath Party loyalists who are, if you like, almost the sort of political commissars watching over their every move. I think it is quite clear that in broad terms, the vast bulk of the Iraqi armed forces has not put up a terribly spectacular resistance to this American onslaught, whether that is because of political reluctance, whether it's simply because they've been outfought and outmaneuvered and taken by surprise, whether it's because command and control from Baghdad has simply collapsed and not been up to the tempo and pace of the operation, we just don't know.
And finally, Jonathan Marcus, all eyes are increasingly focused on Baghdad, but what about the rest of the country? You've got dozens of reporters there. We had days and days of very difficult, restive local populations and militias giving U.S. and U.K. forces a very hard time. What's it look like now? Is that sniping? Are those attacks still going on in Basra, north of Basra, Nasiriyah, and the rest?
This is a very big country, and it's clear that in the areas that the troops have passed through, there is still fighting going on. There have obviously been a number of significant localized offensives by the US and the British to try and get a grip on this. I think the signs are that they're beginning to get a grip on it in places like Nasiriyah and Najaf and even around Basra. I suppose one of the fundamental factors is what happens in Baghdad. I mean, everything that we're being told here is that it's kind of like a snowball. People begin slowly to start providing information, who are the Ba'ath Party supporters, who are the secret police in their midst and so on. And slowly as people gain confidence, that kind of information grows and the snowball starts rolling and they're able to basically mop up more and more elements. I think what is fascinating about all of this, and this is one of the interesting things about the way the debate on the war, particularly in the States, has swung back and forth. In a way, this sniping and this irregular activity did not interrupt the flow of supplies. They have moved forward at great speed. The thing that did hold up things undoubtedly was the bad weather. 3 days or so of absolutely violent and appalling, ugly weather. It's a complex area, but I think whether they have enough troops to pacify local resistance, which could be a very time-consuming and manpower-intensive job, is one thing. But it appears at the moment that they certainly have enough combat power to pursue the broad plan for the envelopment and encirclement of the Iraqi capital.
And as you say, much now hangs on what happens there. Jonathan Marcus, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Jonathan Marcus is military correspondent for the BBC. He spoke with us from Doha, Qatar.
Having traveled hundreds of miles, we will now go the last 200 yards. The course is set. We're on the advance. Our destination is Baghdad, and we will accept nothing less than complete and final victory.
President Bush speaking this morning at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. As U.S. forces converge on the outskirts of Baghdad tonight, there is tremendous speculation about what those troops will face inside the city limits. All-out urban warfare and resistance from the Iraqi Republican Guard, chemical attack and suicide bombers, or little resistance at all. A relentless air campaign helped clear the path for U.S. ground troops, the 1st Marines and Army's 3rd Infantry Division. Marine commanders reportedly stayed up all night trying to keep plans for Baghdad abreast of their troops' rapid advance. A siege could turn Baghdad into a living hell and political debacle. An onslaught could bring terrible casualties, military and civilian. We're looking at options tonight, the options for U.S. forces on the city's doorstep, the options for Iraqi commanders inside. What do the first 2 weeks of war leave you anticipating in Baghdad? Do you smell a trap, a walkover, or something else entirely? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Lexington, Kentucky, is Eugene Goltz, assistant professor at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. He's a consultant to the U.S. Navy. Good evening and welcome, Eugene Goltz.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Also with us from Quantico, Virginia, is retired Colonel John Caldwell, research fellow at the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities, a think tank partnered with the Marine Corps Warfighting Laboratory. He spent 27 years as an infantry officer in the Marines and was chief of Joint Operations Division for U.S. Forces in Korea. Good evening and welcome, Colonel John Caldwell.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Eugene Goltz, first to you, if I may. Sum it up for us. First of all, are we close enough to Baghdad to now be looking at the next phase, or is this still consolidation? Is the next big round what happens on the immediate perimeter and interior of the capital city?
I think you're right to wonder how much consolidation there might be before we proceed, or if we proceed, into the city itself. It does seem the reports today have us coming right up to the outskirts of Baghdad, taking the airport, the latest reports.
At least parts of it at this point.
That's right, exactly. The latest reports suggest that it's coming under our control. And there, I guess, are two possible next steps, right? One argument is that momentum is extremely important in military engagements, and when the other guy is reeling, you follow up on that, and history has rewarded a certain amount of aggressiveness in command. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when you change terrain or reach a new point in the fighting, it's often a good time to regroup, consider options, spend some time, and there are good reasons to believe that we should be cautious, both politically and militarily, about any next step actually getting into the different terrain, the urban terrain in Baghdad.
I guess it's too early to see exactly what U.S. troops are actually doing, pausing or forging on in on their momentum. As you say, following up on the advantage of an enemy who may be reeling, Colonel John Caldwell, what do you see here? Do you see an Iraqi force that is reeling or is potentially concealing some trap, ambush, strategy that's not apparent?
Well, I think that's a changing dynamic right now. If you looked at the Iraqi defense in the initial parts, they, especially down south, they used very asymmetric tactics. And I think it surprised us a little bit. But as we've headed up north, I have frankly been surprised at how the Iraqi regime has left the Republican Guard units out there in the open, mm-hmm. so that our air power can get to them. I was almost expecting that he would, in his state, even though he generally doesn't allow the Republican Guards into the Baghdad, he may be under no other option except to fall back into a fight of the city. Now, I would like to add that, you know, in this particular case, there's a third option besides going continue the momentum of the attack or consolidating and isolating the city.
John Caldwell, hold that third option. We won't hear it, but we've got to take a short break. We're talking this hour about the battle for urban Baghdad. What awaits U.S. troops inside the city limits of Baghdad? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle for urban Baghdad. Today at a press conference, U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld spoke about the road ahead.
The regime has been weakened, to be sure, but it is still lethal, and it may prove to be more lethal in the final moments before it ends.
Donald Rumsfeld, what do you think? From the first 2 weeks of this war, what are you anticipating now in Baghdad? Do you smell a trap, a walkover, something else? With Saddam's back against the wall, what desperate measures do you fear? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Eugene Goltz, joining us from Lexington, Kentucky. He's a consultant to the U.S. Navy from the university there. And from Quantico, Virginia, longtime Marine Colonel John Caldwell joins us. He's with the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities. John Caldwell, you were talking about a third option, an option to either waiting or plunging on in, that being?
Right, and the third option is to take the size of the city a bite at a time. Baghdad is 5 million people, about the size of Los Angeles proper. I don't think this is necessarily an all or nothing proposition. You can do it a section at a time, taking neighborhoods like the Shiite areas on the eastern side and the southwestern side, and gaining some support in that arena.
Eugene Goltz, we're reading two things coming out of the Pentagon today, or the U.S. military in the region as well. On the one hand, the big message, above all, we do not want a siege because the consequences for the civilians inside could be so horrible that the political cost to the United States of the images of that suffering going out would be unacceptable. At the same time, we read here a senior military official saying, if it becomes an all-out hand-to-hand urban battle for Baghdad, then we'll have done something wrong. John Caldwell suggesting maybe we grab off pieces of it, but how do you do that without this? What are the options to siege or hand-to-hand combat in an urban setting?
Well, I think the Colonel Caldwell's suggestion that we might go methodically a section at a time is almost certainly what we would do. And in fact, I think the plunging on in, trying to take all the city all at once, is something that is highly unlikely to see. There's actually quite a bit of experience with armies racing for the city center. This is what the Russians did in Grozny, for example, and getting cut off and stuck there. And
in their case, losing 1,500 troops and losing that advance on the city.
Exactly. So I don't think there's any chance that the United States is likely to try that option. We're not that overconfident, which is what the Russians were. Mm-hmm. But that said, it is quite likely, I think, because the siege is so such an unpalatable option, and because we really do seem to believe that the administration has said over and over again they believe that the Iraqis are just on the brink of giving up. It's just a little push, and even the best Iraqi units are going to stop fighting. They're eager to give that little push, and so my estimation is that the comment that you got out of the Pentagon that if it's hand-to-hand fighting in the streets, we've done something wrong, is based on the idea that through the next phase of shock and awe, bewildering, confusing the Iraqi forces, and convincing them that this is a hopeless fight, that they'll all lay down their weapons and welcome us in to Iraq. And so that's the deus ex machina that, you know, would solve all of these problems. But I think much more likely they will continue to fight in probably traditional urban fighting styles.
That is the U.S. or the Iraqis?
The Iraqis will. They will not immediately lay down. They're not quite as close to the brink of giving up as some of the statements that we're hearing.
Mm. And we want to talk about whether or not they will, in fact, adopt traditional urban fighting styles. But before we do, Colonel Caldwell, this this idea of grabbing off pieces of Baghdad one at a time, paint a picture for how that would actually happen. If it's not hand-to-hand fighting, what's the combination of air, ground, technology, strategy that suggests itself here?
Well, I think let's take a look at the scale between, for example, Basra and Baghdad. Basra, where the British forces are now, is a city of about 500,000. And what they've done is, and the tactics and the strategy that they're using in that case, is to isolate the city and start developing an intelligence picture of where the bad guys are, mm-hmm. where the Fedayeen are, and they're going to befriend the local populace and try to gain their trust as rapidly as they can, and then periodically, as Mr. Gold suggests, go in there very quickly and rapidly to seize some objectives and keep them off balance. I think there's a combination of approaches that you can use. And so if we do see opportunities, I think we will strike. But I also agree that we need to be cautious. This, if we do this right, it does not have to be a rerun of Black Hawk Down. As a matter of fact,
this in Mogadishu, Somalia, a real disaster for U.S. Rangers there.
Well, it certainly was a difficult situation.
Bad day.
It was. But I think we will have to be able to avoid running into the densely populated area without any idea of what we're getting into. So we need to have a good intelligence picture.
Eugene Goltz, do you feel the confidence that that can happen? We saw some fairly wild scenes in and around cities in the south as irregular troops and regular troops dressed in civilian clothes came at U.S. forces with all kinds of civilian vehicles, but some weaponry enough to harass them. They had a lot of air cover there, harder to give that air cover in the city. Can U.S. forces get into Baghdad, even parts that they've probed, without risking finding themselves suddenly in really bad circumstances?
Well, I'm not optimistic. As I said, I think that a key part of the best-case hope is that we'll find out that there aren't very many people willing to fight for the regime. But it probably doesn't even take very many core supporters of the regime to really give us trouble as we try to make these incursions. Or I'm not sure that it will be quite as catch-as-catch-can as Colonel Caldwell has suggested a little bit. I think we'll have to be quite methodical sealing off different parts of the city, because even if there's only a small core of enemy in the city, if they can engage us where we're weak relative to them, and when they find out that they're in an area that we're overmatching them, if they have the ability to run, to use the fact that sight lines are heavily obstructed in the urban environment, to get away and fight another hour as opposed to another day, but just to move to a different street, it's going to be very hard to clamp down on even a very small number of enemy forces. And I think that means we need to have enough forces in the area to really patrol and establish blocking positions to prevent that kind of neighborhood-to-neighborhood moving around the city by the enemy. I mean, this could be like squeezing a balloon, and you can't squeeze in one place and move them all to another place. You have to squeeze in a lot of places at once to pop that balloon.
And what about really unorthodox approaches? CNN is reporting tonight that trucks have been driving through the streets of Baghdad, urging citizens of Baghdad, residents of Baghdad, civilians, to march en masse to the airport and present a kind of human wave in front of U.S. forces there. We heard a report earlier today from around Shiite holy sites in Najaf of mobs of Iraqis who were not even hostile. They just didn't want U.S. forces getting near the central shrines, pushing them back just by the mass of the mob. Is it possible that Saddam or whoever's in charge now could turn out just human waves of people who would make military operations almost impossible, Eugene Goltz?
I think that's absolutely a likely scenario or a likely problem. I don't think it's even human waves of disrupting us or pushing us back or trying to prevent us from getting in the city. I think there are going to be a lot of scared people in Baghdad, and any time we move in behind pass a block, there are going to be a whole lot of people who would like to become refugees who are going to want to leave the city. And say that's 20% of the population of the liberated parts of Baghdad, very quickly we're going to end up with not just tens of thousands, but you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees in the desert that are going to complicate all our logistics planning. No one has tried ever before to put together refugee
food, water, everything else.
Exactly. For that many people, it's just going to completely complicate our planning.
So even the population itself, even if it's not hostile, becomes a major factor here. Eugene Gold's John Caldwell standby. A lot of callers want to join us. I'd like to turn to them. Eric's calling from Wausau, Wisconsin. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just had a question for the your speakers about what are the chances of Saddam just sitting and waiting for to blow a nuclear weapon or biological right in the city and try to take out as many people and as many soldiers as possible.
You think he would take out all the Iraqis along with U.S. troops, Eric?
Yes, I would think he would because he just probably would not want to go down. He would want to just blow up the whole thing.
Out in bloody glory. Well, let's ask. Eric, thanks for your call. Colonel John Caldwell, I guess two things there. First, what do you make of the relative ease with which U.S. troops have come to this point? Could there be a kind of deliberate trap here? And secondly, can you imagine Saddam Hussein, is there a way that he could use weapons of mass destruction in or in the near vicinity of Baghdad that would not be suicidal, might even go the suicidal route?
Well, I'm reminded by a statement I read today where someone said, you know, when the attack is going great, you may be just walking into an ambush. So clearly there is that thing that that issue that we have to be very concerned with. The other issue, and that is the asymmetry with using civilians and mixing combatants and non-combatants, is clearly a very complex issue for our forces to deal with. And we may not have enough forces on the ground at this point to do that. I'm not there, but the commanders have to make that call. With respect to the speakers, the caller's question about whether Saddam may use some other types of weapons.
Chemical, nuclear.
Yeah. He certainly has had opportunities before. And in my assessment, if he does that to his own people, I think there will be some repercussions that that may be negative. And so if he was to use that, I suspect he probably would have done it, you know, while we got in the red zone, so to speak.
When we got close,
before
U.S. troops actually got nearly into the city.
That's what I think.
Mm. Eugene Goltz, do you have that fear? Is it too late for Saddam Hussein to go chemical or nuclear?
I don't think so. Well, I think it's too late for him to go nuclear in the sense that I'm fairly confident that he does not at this time have a nuclear weapon. He clearly demonstrated the intent over the past 12 years and even before that to try to get one, but he doesn't have one, so I don't think that's a likely risk. The chemical issue is, I think, different. My guess is that thus far his theory of victory in the war involves bogging us down and negotiating a settlement, perhaps with the help of the international community, that would allow him to stay in power under tight restrictions and more international monitoring. That's the best case for him. And as soon as he uses chemical weapons, that's out the window. So it would truly be a desperation measure. On the other hand,
it seems as though that's already out the window if we can believe Donald Rumsfeld's repeated assertions that
today.
That is not on the table.
Exactly, which means that I'm not sure I would have expected to see chemical use in the red zone in the area just outside Baghdad. If Saddam only has a little bit of chemical, he has to use it very strategically, and his best strategy is to use it in the city for two reasons. First, because it's likely to cause a lot of civilian casualties, which he will try to get the Arab media to blame on the United States, and he'll use that to buck up his support. And the second thing is, urban warfare is a very disoriented thing, even for well-trained troops like the Americans. The biggest complaint that soldiers have in the urban environment is that they feel like they can't see their friends, they feel isolated and cut off and confused, and they can't look in all directions around them. If you have to wear a chemical warfare suit in the urban environment,
then that's just all the more.
Exactly. And our fighting effectiveness would plunge under those circumstances. With the soldiers being afraid they're going to step on broken glass and get their suit ripped, or they're going to get cautious, they're going to get lost, confused. I mean, that's a real – it just seems like it compounds all the problems of the urban environment. So if he has chemical and if he decides to use it, he would probably want to maximize the payoff in that kind of sense.
Rich is calling from Bolton, Massachusetts. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
How are you doing tonight?
Great, thanks.
I have an interesting possibility, and maybe it's part of the trap that you're talking about, and I'd like to hear some comments on it. So we know that Aziz went to Damascus just prior to the war starting.
Tariq Aziz, yes.
Yeah, no, I'm curious to know, and I've heard rumor of this, about the possibility that maybe Saddam is not even in Baghdad.
Well, that raises a couple of possibilities. Let's look at them, Rich. Thanks for your call. Colonel John Caldwell, there's been a lot of conversation in the Pentagon and in the region in the last 24 or 48 hours to the effect that Iraqi military's command and control is appears to be very disrupted. Could that go all the way to the top? How much disruption are you reading into their pattern of behavior?
Well, I think that's the $50,000 question that, you know, no one really knows. But from my where I see things, I think there has been, at least at the beginning of this conflict, some type of coherent strategy on the Iraqi side.
Mm-hmm.
And as the conflict has progressed, their options have become more and more limited. I am somewhat puzzled that we have not seen any evidence that Saddam is rallying his forces, and that the director of his airport this morning says, "Hey, look, we've got control of the airport," only to turn around 12 hours later and have U.S. forces standing right there. So I think there is some possibility that he may be incapacitated. Now, whether that means there's no good command and control structure, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Or could be even out of town, Eugene Goltz, there's this talk of a real final last stand, not in Baghdad, but in Tikrit to the north, Saddam Hussein's hometown. Well, does it matter in terms of Baghdad whether or not that's a contingency for Saddam or whoever's running the show there?
Well, I think there are lots of possible contingencies. I think the answer is we don't know. And it will be very hard for us to know, even after everything is settled, if Saddam is dead or alive. There will be lots of possibilities if he just disappears, we'll try to find him, but we're trying to find some other key figures who have opposed the United States, and we're not having much luck. So that's a very tough challenge. And in fact, before the war started, President Bush went out of his way to try to make it clear that it's not a reasonable standard of victory to say, "Can I, you know, put Saddam Hussein's head on a pike on the city gates?" He just wants to make sure there's regime change in Iraq. So if we control all of Iraq and there's a successor government, it doesn't really matter whether there's a last stand in Baghdad or in Tikrit, or if Saddam disappears into the ether, or if we kill him.
And in just the minute we've got before the break, what about this notion that John Caldwell raised, that we may not have enough troops at the moment to go on in? It's going to take them a while to arrive. Will we essentially have some kind of siege here no matter what, if U.S. troops feel they need to wait for reinforcements around Baghdad?
Well, I would think that that's a likely scenario. That's a cautious, methodical scenario, which I guess I would support.
Does it amount to a siege, whatever you want to call it?
A siege to me means more than just having our forces outside the city and waiting to plunge in. A siege involves consciously trying to cut off all food, to disrupt the lives of the people in the city, to starve them out, right? That would be our strategy for weakening the Republican Guard. And I think we could probably have a pause and consolidation phase.
But still, I wonder about those truckloads of vegetables and food and whatever else coming in and out. If that can happen, we're talking tonight about the battle for urban Baghdad. Are you confident U.S.-led forces can win in the streets of the Iraqi capital? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle for urban Baghdad shaping up right now in Iraq. Lights out, electricity out in Baghdad tonight, today, for the first time in the first 2 weeks of this war. U.S. troops now on the tarmac. We are told at Saddam International Airport. and all kinds of reports about what may or may not be going on inside Baghdad. What's your best hope? What's your worst fear as U.S. troops close in on the Iraqi capital? And what level of casualties can you tolerate, U.S. casualties, Iraqi casualties, in the battle for Baghdad? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Eugene Goltz in Lexington, Kentucky at the University of Kentucky. They're a consultant to the U.S. Navy. And from Quantico, Virginia, with retired Colonel John Caldwell. We're joined right now from Walpole, Massachusetts by Andrew Basevich. He's director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University, a 23-year veteran of the U.S. Army, a retired colonel there, and author of American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Basevich.
Thank you very much.
We've been looking at the parameters of what's shaping up here. As you look at the situation now, U.S. troops have come very quickly to the near perimeter now of Baghdad. What do you see as the best options for U.S. Forces going forward? And what do you see as the best options of perhaps a dwindling hand that the Iraqi command holds?
Well, I don't know if this is exactly responding to your question, but my sort of immediate reaction is, in the last day and a half or so, we're reminded of how quickly the shape of a battle changes. And then we began with a great pulse of American success, Anglo-American success. We had that period of time when things didn't go so well. Now all of a sudden it's going well again.
And it's a real roller coaster ride.
What we should be reminded is that doesn't necessarily guarantee that we are assured of complete success from here on out. Mm-hmm. It can shift back the other way. So a certain caution. It appears, as much as we can know, that we've done very well against the Republican Guards arrayed around the city of Baghdad. But, of course, that's the kind of fight that we tend to be good at, a conventional fight, one in which American firepower can really be brought to bear. And my own concern, and I may be repeating things that your guests have said, I just got home, my own concern is that a fight in the city of Baghdad will be one in which American firepower may have to be restrained, and in which more of a fight in which it's soldier against soldier is going to come to be the center of things. And in that regard, the comment I heard you made before that about do we really have enough soldiers, mm-hmm. combat soldiers on the ground, certainly is something that we're going to want to have to watch.
There's been talk of U.S. forces not trying to close in from the outside, but actually going right in to the center of Baghdad, using some of those devastated presidential palace locations as kind of landing zones for helicopters, fighting this war from the inside out. Is that a doable strategy, Andrew Basevich?
I mean, that would be a very bold course of action from a guy sitting in Walpole, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
But recognize that the intelligence picture that we have is so very incomplete. The intelligence picture that commanders in the field have is also incomplete, but is certainly much better than our own. And if indeed their read of the situation is that Iraqi security forces are really on the verge of collapse, then perhaps that very bold course of action would be justified. Difficult for us to try to second guess, given the very limited information that we have.
And what about troop ratios here? We read that historically a kind of 9-to-1 advantage is ideal for the offensive force in this kind of setting. I think the U.S. forces are at something like a 20,000 troop level in the Baghdad vicinity. And inside Baghdad, I'm not sure. We've read about 20,000 in the Special Republican Guard.
Right.
We don't know how many regular Republican Guard have retreated there. It could be as many as 100,000
right.
Iraqi troops inside.
And if, again, and there's uncertainty that the commanders are grappling with, is a very great uncertainty, if indeed the read would still be that those forces are going to put up a tough fight, then you might say, hey, wait a second, let's pause here. Let's try to bring in additional forces let's take a deliberate approach to capturing Baghdad. But if your read is that the successes of the past couple of days have created a momentum, then it may make more sense to pile on.
To pile on with what we've got available.
And to take the bold, to make the bold effort, and you know, try to go for the big jackpot.
Well,
but again, it really depends on the intelligence available, and it's very difficult for us from our vantage point to have any kind of a feel for that.
There's the range of possibilities. Andrew Bacevich, I want to thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich is director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University and a 23-year veteran in the U.S. Army. He retired as a colonel there. Eugene Goltz, I think I heard you.
Yeah. Well, I was hoping to comment a little on what Andy Bacevich was saying.
Please.
He's right, absolutely, that this would be a very bold move to airlift American forces into the middle of Baghdad. The question is, no matter how good the intelligence on the ground may be that we don't have sitting here in the United States, and he's right that presumably they have better information than we do, that's a very risky strategy, and the United States would have to ask, how could it be worth the risk to us to do that? If we got a group of soldiers cut off and trapped downtown in Baghdad, this would be so disastrous for us, both politically and actually militarily, because as you said, we have something like 20,000 soldiers near to Baghdad, but a lot of those are not infantry shooters, the kind of soldiers that you want downtown. If we have a too armor-heavy a force. Now, it's not true that you don't want to bring armor into urban conflict. You do want some armor, but the ratio of armor to infantry in the urban environment is different than in the outside of the city. And we would be actually in our infantry units, rifle companies, will be a very valuable commodity that we basically can't afford to squander on high risk but potentially high payoff. We really need to be very methodical and very cautious about this so that we don't run out of soldiers in the theater.
But what about the other risk, a hypothetical here, John Caldwell? Eugene Goltz asks, why would we want to put those troops at risk? What if we see a siege developing whether we like it or not? U.S. troops are on the outside. It's hard to keep proper food and utilities and water flowing into Baghdad. Saddam Hussein or whoever's in charge might deliberately aggravate that to the point where there's a humanitarian crisis in Baghdad. Is it possible that U.S. forces will feel compelled to go in to stop a kind of, laying waste strategy by the Baghdad regime itself?
You know, that certainly is a possibility, but I would caution that we should look long and hard, because the downside risks just far outweigh the upside gains. In the case of, for example, down in Basra again, you know, the British has kept the water flowing. They've kept the electricity going. And we can do much of the same thing. I mean, we said we didn't turn out the lights. We need to recognize that we have to have a sort of a sound approach, because there are limits to technology that someone brought up earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There are risks to our forces when they compete against, you know, irregulars mixed in with civilians. The weapons that you use in an urban environment, things like mortars and so forth, are area fire and will create damage to civilian infrastructure. So we have to either use precision weapons or go man-to-man, so to speak, soldier-to-soldier. Those kinds of skills are hard to train to, and while our soldiers are very good at it, the fact of the matter is casualty rates will climb very rapidly.
Do I hear you suggesting that we can't afford to lose too many because our first rank of fighters of that type is not infinite?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. But having said that, I think what we really need to do is to make sure that we have a clear strategy that will allow us to take out the Special Republican Guards and the Fedayeen over time. We don't want to win this war in 9 days, declare victory, and then find ourselves in an insurgency environment for 9 months or 9 years. I mean, that's pretty drastic. So I think completing the task at hand is much more important than just quickly rushing through it.
Mm. Patrick's calling. Welcome, Patrick. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much for taking me on.
Mm-hmm.
This conflict has involved a lot of values and virtues in clash. I wanted to say by that we went in here with a lot of unfinished diplomacy. Mm. And as such, the way we finish the battle will also determine a lot as to how we manage the post-conflict era.
It certainly will.
So there should be some concern for finesse. This is the citadel, the capital of a country, which has a big symbol in the Arab world.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we end this conflict at this juncture, I envision the possibility of, there was a word used there, sieging,
mm-hmm.
Taking siege on the capital. That word is even too strong. There's a way of holding the capital, but this would have been the right moment to reintegrate maybe the UN and possibly get the negotiators back to really verify and confirm or infirm about the chemical weapon, because the scenario they're talking about having chemical weapon fight in that capital
mm-hmm.
really speaks of a possibility I really just don't think we should be imagining.
It's hard to imagine George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld inviting UN weapons inspectors back in at this point. But we take your point, Patrick, about the finesse required here and the possibility of a kind of loose embrace of the capital, Eugene Goltz, that might shake loose or shake apart Iraqi command solidarity inside. Republican Guard have traditionally not even been allowed into Baghdad for fear of civil war or some kind of coup d'etat. How would you rate the possibilities of that emerging in this pressure cooker?
Well, I think at this point, we just don't know very much about how the personal relationships among different Iraqi military leaders and political leaders are holding up, about who might be engaging intrigue with whom and who might not be. My guess is that most military leaders, these are at least in their own way, many of them are quite competent professional soldiers, and they're concerned with the military issues at hand, not with political intrigue. I don't think we should
even in what may be the dying days of a regime when they've been threatened with, you know, military trial if they're found to be on the wrong side of Washington.
Well, if they engage in war crimes, that's true. But if they think they're fighting defense of their homeland is another, that we shouldn't be surprised that the best trained, most elite, favored troops, people who have benefited personally from this regime, we shouldn't be surprised that these people are willing to fight against a foreign invader. That's normal.
Mm-hmm.
That happens in countries throughout the world under all sorts of different circumstances. And it would be highly unusual, possible, but highly unusual to see them giving up in droves or launching a coup under these circumstances, even if they might have launched a coup had they been invited into Baghdad during relative peacetime.
And
things are different when you're under military attack.
And John Caldwell, just a minute left, but given how difficult this may be, can you see U.S. forces coming out of this with both a victory and a military victory and a political victory? That is, to be seen as having won without squandering too much Iraqi blood.
I think we're going to have to walk very, very carefully into that area. And by that, I mean, if you want to have a military victory, then one of the things you want to try to avoid is the house-to-house, street-to-street type of fighting. We've got to develop the intelligence infrastructure, like we talked about earlier, and go after the key nodes and the key leaders. Now, admittedly, that's going to be difficult because we don't know who those people are. There are lots of them. But I think at the same time, on the political side, we need to keep our eye on the ball and say winning the war may be easier than just winning the peace subsequently. The fog of war may turn into a fog of peace.
Let's hope that it doesn't take too long to get this phase as peacefully as possible completed. John Caldwell joining us from Quantico, Virginia. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Colonel John Caldwell is a research fellow at the Center for Emerging Threats and Opportunities, a think tank partnered with the Marine Corps Warfighting Laboratory. And Eugene Goltz, thanks for being with us in Lexington, Kentucky.
My pleasure.
Eugene Goltz is at the University of Kentucky. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this